This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. In the mid-90s, the men's basketball team at New Mexico State University was in trouble. Because of an academic scandal involving phantom classes, the team was barred from tournament competition. Several players transferred. Others were declared ineligible. Russ Bradford, who'd only recently been hired as an assistant coach, had a heck of a job on his hands.
Suddenly I had to replace an entire team, and one of the other coaches got fired and another one left. And so I was by myself with a head coach that was not active in recruiting. So I had to replace 13 guys by myself.
Before joining the staff at New Mexico State, Coach Bradford had lived and worked in Chicago. He focused his most energetic recruiting effort on one of the guys he'd seen there playing for Marshall High School. His name was Sean Harrington.
And he was small and skinny, but you could see that he really, really knew the game. He was the smartest player on the floor, and he played for Luther Bedford, who was the man that became famous a couple of years later for his role in the film Hoop Dreams. And so Sean, you could tell he was different. As soon as the game ended, he would hug the guys on the other team, and he'd hug his teammates and shake hands with the referees, and he was kind and generous.
Bradford's recruiting style was to befriend the players he wanted to sign. He'd get to know their families. He'd ask how they were doing in school.
I always said to recruits, listen, take your time. We want you. You know, we're going to be friends either way. But in this case, I called him and he said, I think I might go visit Arizona and Oklahoma. They want me to come visit now. And I just had enough. I was tired and I just sort of blurted out, look, you can go visit those schools if you want to, Sean, but if you don't sign with us tomorrow by noon, I'm going to give your scholarship to somebody else.
I asked Sean Harrington whether he recalled being pressured by Bradford.
No, I don't. I don't, but I wouldn't doubt that he tightened the screws up trying to put the pressure on me to make a decision, I'm sure.
The truth was, there was nobody else. I didn't have anybody else. And he called me back within an hour and said, okay, I'm ready to sign.
Sean Harrington immediately became the best player on a bad team. He led New Mexico State in scoring, steals, and assists, and his enthusiasm was boundless. Russ Bradford recalls that Harrington made a point of going to the women's games and leading cheers for them. So Bradford might have forgotten about his common, if dishonest, recruiting trick.
But then against San Jose State in early January, he went down with a bad knee injury.
Sean finished the game on a bad knee. That night, he went to bed hoping for the best.
It was that next morning when I woke up, and it looked like maybe someone had put a softball under my skin. My knee was swollen up.
And that was it. He was done for the year. And now we've got to decide, do we bring Sean back?
The program couldn't afford to provide a scholarship to a player who was no longer as good as he'd been. It was a decision complicated, as these sorts of decisions sometimes are, by the academic challenges Sean was facing.
Sean got a D in his Spanish class.
Yeah, it was hard to be in the Spanish classroom where everyone was speaking Spanish, including the teacher.
Head coach Neil McCarthy stopped thinking of Sean as part of the program. Bradford accepted his decision.
I think I had every chance to say, wait just a second here. This is a good kid. I know his mother. I know his high school coach. I've met his girlfriend. We can't just get rid of a guy because he's injured. But I didn't do it. So I'm willing to accept my part in that responsibility of not bringing him back.
Did it feel bad?
No, not at the time.
Subsequent events, at least immediately subsequent events, gave Bradford no reason to feel differently. Harrington transferred to Northwest Missouri State. After he'd sat out a year, his knee was fine. He earned Division II All-American honors. At about the time he graduated, Harrington learned that his girlfriend was pregnant. Though his mother had urged him to stay away from Chicago, Sean returned to the city so his daughter would have a father present, something he hadn't experienced. Because he still had dreams about a career in the game, he played some lower-tier pro basketball. He also worked at the Boys and Girls Club and eventually began to scout high school players. Bradford kept in touch with Sean for a while, and then he didn't, until 2003.
I had heard that his mother was murdered.
Sean's mother had walked into a neighbor's home while a robbery was in progress. She was shot in the head and died in the neighbor's backyard.
And I just thought, well, let me call him and reach out to him. So we spoke for a while then, and of course he was devastated.
Bradford didn't call again, and perhaps then in 2003, 7 years after they'd parted company in New Mexico, he figured he had nothing more to say to Sean Harrington.
And then in 2014, 11 years later, I got the phone call that's saying, hey, that kid you guys used to have, Sean Harrington, has been shot in Chicago and they don't know what's going to happen to him.
Well, it was a normal day for me. Same routine, picking my daughter up on my way to work to drop her off at school. Pulled up to the stoplight and noticed a guy standing on the corner pointing at my car. Next thing I know, me and my daughter was under fire by a barrage of bullets. I instinctively just kind of pushed her down and covered up my body as much as I could till I heard the shooting stop, which seemed like an eternity.
You saved her life.
Yeah, that's what everybody say. I'm a hero, but I just doing what I think any dad would do.
Gang members had mistaken Sean's car for somebody else's. 20 minutes earlier, there had been another shooting nearby. The first police officer to arrive on the scene assumed Sean was a combatant rather than a victim.
He did stereotype me when he walked up to the car, came up and yanked me by my shoulder and went to yank me out of the car. And I was like, hold on, officer. I told him I couldn't feel my legs.
One bullet in that barrage had fractured two vertebrae, depriving Sean Harrington of the use of his legs. Russ Bradbury didn't know all that when he called Harrington again. All he knew was that the man who had been that enthusiastic young basketball player might need a friend.
When he called, I thought he was being genuine. I thought he was genuinely concerned and genuinely showed love. And at that time, I had so much stuff going on negative, I didn't have any room for any negative feelings or negative thoughts at that time.
As a former coach, and more significantly, as a man who'd known Sean's family and been familiar with his basketball dreams, Bradbury could help Sean shove aside those negative thoughts. But he'd begun to feel badly about failing to stand up for Harrington 18 years earlier, when Harrington was dropped from the New Mexico State team. He felt that at least he might have made himself more available to the young man he'd recruited. When Bradbury visited Harrington in the hospital, he felt he had to say something.
I was there for a couple hours with him and said, listen, I'm sorry the way that happened. And he said, no, that was my decision to leave New Mexico State. And then he sort of, you know, gazed out the window and thought, I've always wondered if I did the right thing, that maybe I should have stayed.
It need hardly be said that memory is a funny thing. What the two men had in common was that the present mattered a lot more to each of them than did the past. And after that violent case of mistaken identity on the Chicago streets, the present didn't look good for Sean Harrington.
Pretty quickly after getting shot, his paycheck stopped after 90 days and his health insurance stopped.
Bradbury began contacting everybody he could think of who might be able to help Sean get back to work as part of his rehabilitation. He publicized Sean's years of service to Chicago's youngsters at Marshall High School and elsewhere. He made sure everybody who heard his story knew that Sean had saved his daughter's life. Eventually, he got in touch with a fellow who'd been the CEO of the Chicago Public Schools and who had become the Secretary of Education in the Obama administration.
And it was when I spoke to Arne Duncan that within a week or 10 days, they called him and they've redefined his job. He's now a restorative justice counselor at Marshall.
Sean Harrington works to de-escalate the disagreements and fights in school that can lead to murder in the street.
Russ became my biggest advocate, is what he did. I said it a million times over. I don't know where I would be right now today, mentally and physically, if it wasn't for Russ Bradbury. From Las Cruces to Mexico to Chicago, he's been able to help me in so many ways. So I think this is a guy that was genuinely cared about what was going on with one of his former players.
But gainful employment doesn't mean Sean's troubles are over.
I think the struggles have continued, partly because six of his players were murdered. And then another, the kid Martin Satterfield, was shot six times but lived. But he's in a wheelchair like Sean is. And so I think each shooting has really devastated Sean. In fact, he only went to one funeral. And then after that, he just could not bring himself to keep going to the funerals.
Murderous violence has taken from Sean Harrington his mother, friends, and former teammates. The daughter, whose life he saved, has gone on to college. His younger daughter is a big part of the reason Sean remains enthusiastic about the game he once played so well.
She's the hooper, so I'm thrilled about that, getting to spend time in the gym. and she wants to play basketball. So that's the thing. It's not like I'm forcing it up on her or have to worry about her mom or grandma. Like, you forcing it too much. You being too hard on her. The fact that she wants to play basketball, I love it. I can definitely groom her to be in the point guard. I can tell you that much. If she grow to be 6'7", we're going to teach her to be point guard.
She'll be a Magic Johnson type point
yes.
guard. There is joy in thinking about that aspect of the future, and Sean Harrington believes his own prospects are brighter than some might think.
That's one thing I got full faith in, that I definitely will get up out this chair again. I mean, it has been some positive signs with sensation coming back in my abdomen, my lower legs, and I feel little things, a little subtle things that I hadn't felt before, so it's all promising to me. Can't no doctor, nobody else tell me I won't get up out this chair.
Russ Bradbird's book about Sean Harrington's story and his own is titled All the Dreams We've Dreamed, a story of hoops and handguns on Chicago's West Side. We'll have a link to it at onlyagame.org. Want to make sure you never miss a second of Only a Game? Subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. And while you're there, leave a review. It's absolutely the best way to get a shout-out on Only a Game, like this one for listener EKM Tipper, who recently wrote, "For years, my routine includes a long jog on Saturdays. Only a Game entertains me through the miles. I have been known to laugh out loud or even shed a tear when I hear Bill say the final word. I'm disappointed, as I know the remainder of the run will be significantly harder without OAG playing." Thanks, EKM Tipper, and thanks to everyone who's left us a review on their podcast app or shared one of our stories on Facebook or Twitter. It really does help other listeners to find our show. John Hoff and Al Viverberg grew up watching Don Cherry skate for the AHL's Rochester Americans, and then they learned Cherry was coming to coach their high school team.
I think we were all a little intimidated.
We did have the most well-known in the area high school hockey coach, that's for sure.
That story's coming up on Only a Game from NPR.
Hey, I'm Kelly McEvers, host of NPR's Embedded, and we've got a new episode all about how Scott Pruitt ended up running the EPA. It's a story about Pruitt's life in the Southern Baptist Church, how he handled a major pollution case, and why he sued the EPA 14 times. Just search for Embedded on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Back in 2013, cheerleaders for Washington's NFL team took a trip to Costa Rica to take photographs for the squad's swimsuit calendar, and now some of those women are saying the trip made them very uncomfortable and they felt unsafe. That's where we're going to begin on this week's Three Stories You Should Know. I'm joined by sports writer and editor Patrick Ruby via Skype and by WBUR Shira Springer. Welcome to both of you.
Great to be back.
Great to be here.
In a New York Times article this week, Juliet McCour tells the story of that trip to Costa Rica back in 2013. The cheerleaders were at times asked to pose topless, and high-rolling guests of the team were invited to watch that photo shoot. Some of the cheerleaders have said that after the shoot, they were directed to accompany some of the high rollers to a nightclub, the high rollers having picked them out. The supervisor of the squad maintains the cheerleaders were, quote, invited rather than directed. This story is a lot more detailed than a lot of the stories we've heard in the past, but in one sense, it's simply more the same thing. NFL cheerleaders are objectified, underpaid, subject to ridiculous, insulting, and arbitrary rules regarding behavior and their diets. Some of these cheerleaders on the Costa Rica trip have reported that they felt, and I'm using their words now, pimped out. Have we got finally enough reasons to eliminate the phenomenon of NFL cheerleaders?
Yes, I think we have reached the tipping point. I think we actually reached the tipping point years ago. If this doesn't send a signal to the league, to teams, that cheerleading has to go, that it's simply not a safe environment for these women, that they are being exploited in addition to being degraded, then I don't know what will. Unfortunately, in the article, the New York Times article that you mention, one of the cheerleaders said that she doesn't think it will reach the breaking point until something absolutely horrible happens, mm-hmm. a rape or a sexual assault.
Patrick, do you go along with this, or are you going to stand up for cheerleaders?
So hear me out here. I have a crazy proposition.
Uh-oh.
We could get rid of cheerleading. And yes, it's corny and it's retrograde. It's exploitative. And everything, the way the NFL handles it, is reportedly terrible. But now this is crazy. We could also just treat cheerleaders like other employees, like valuable marketing employees. Like, we could treat them like assets instead of commodities, and we could treat them professionally. I know that's crazy for an NFL team to do. But you could actually not put them in dangerous positions. You could actually pay them reasonable wages. You could actually have proper security. You could actually even do something corny like a swimsuit calendar, but do it in a professional manner. Cheerleaders could actually be an incredible forward-facing asset marketing tool for a professional sports team. It doesn't have to be this bad, but they choose to make it this bad.
I like what Patrick is saying, but I feel we're well past sort of the three strikes with it. This has been going on for decades and decades. What is it? The horse is out of the barn with this kind
of stuff. Reform is unlikely at this point.
Exactly. I don't think the NFL is the type of organization where you can safely do all the things that Patrick is suggesting.
Unfortunately, you're probably right. You know, my proposal was theoretical, but in reality, trusting the NFL to be able to execute it probably
yes.
won't happen. Look, they have enough problems treating their own players like regular employees.
Shira, your story involves two allegations. One is doping, and the other is extortion. And I'm going to leave it to you to explain how this all works.
Oh, man, Bill. So let's go to Kenya and hear about the positive drug test of Asbel Kiprop. If you don't know him, he is the most dominant 1,500-meter runner of the last decade. He has an Olympic gold medal, 3 world championships. And he recently tested positive for EPO, a banned blood booster. But that's not where the real story is. He claims he was extorted. Apparently, 2 drug testing officials arrived at his home in Kenya and wanted money for a clean test. Kiprop went, apparently, to pay them. He didn't pay them enough money, and he says they tainted his sample and he tested positive. I don't know whether to believe Kiprop, but it's certainly believable. Things like this happen when it comes to doping all the time. I think the whole testing mechanism is not above board. Is there any hope? Is there any hope for clean sport if this is where we are? I mean, and this comes on top of Russia and other countries having similar issues with corruption in their anti-doping apparatus.
Patrick, can you hold out to Shira the possibility that there may be some hope?
No, I cannot.
Oh, dear.
Unfortunately, you know, anti-doping is a longstanding systemic failure. It just doesn't work. Look, I'm very sympathetic to athletes who don't want to dope and yet want to be able to compete at the elite levels. I feel bad for them. But unfortunately, the way the system is, the incentives are to dope because we want superhuman performances and we reward that. And so as long as that's the case, people are going to be doping. And basically, it's like alcohol prohibition. You essentially create a crime problem. You create the conditions for extortion and for state-sponsored extortion like we saw in Russia. And I think we could have a better and safer and saner system if we took off these prohibitions and instead sort of had actual, legitimate, non-quacky doctors come in and monitor these athletes for health concerns and sort of tried to have more controlled doping instead of the underground wild, wild west system we currently have.
Another question occurs. How easy is it to taint somebody's sample with EPO? Do you go to a pharmacy and say, I'd like some EPO, please, and then just pour it into the sample? I don't know about that. There have been so many instances of doping in track and field, men, women from all countries, the U.S. included, that somebody who says, no, no, I didn't really do it, nobody's going to believe them because this is the way life works in this sport, and it has been for such a long time. This particular story has so many elements with the doping, the extortion, the charges, the countercharges. I see a made-for-TV movie any day now, Shira.
Yeah, made-for-TV movie, or you really hope that the governing body of track and field and other sports bodies come down really hard on Kenya, and that's the outcome. I mean, I'd like the movie, but I'd really like to see people go after Kenya, because let's not forget, this has been the dominant country, you know, for a long time in distance and middle distance running. And I just feel that it you further contaminate this sport, and you end up in a place like cycling, perhaps. Or maybe they're already there.
Patrick, I understand that at least one politician north of the border is unhappy with, well, with us and with the way hockey is presented.
That's right. Forget about the Korean Peninsula. We've got a flashpoint in international relations here between the United States and Canada, and it involves the National Hockey League. Uh-oh. So earlier this week, Canadian Senator David Adams Richards gave an official speech to his parliamentary colleagues about the rising unaddressed menace of American announcers injecting too many American-sounding phrases into Mother Canada's favorite game that isn't curling. So hockey.
Long ago and far away, when I was a boy, we wore hockey sweaters, not hockey jerseys.
Locker rooms instead of dressing rooms. Half walls instead of boards.
Shameful. Shameful.
We didn't delay at the blue line. We stopped at the blue line. Nor did we take a wrist there. What an insulting word. We took a wrist shot. Nor did we take a slapper. What an insulting word. We took a slap shot.
Do you feel the hot maple syrup bleeding from your ears?
I think they don't have enough problems in Canada, so they have to come up with something like this.
Yes, that is exactly what this is, inventing a conflict.
Yeah. I await the backlash, Patrick. We're going to hear from hockey fans who really love the creative language, I'm sure. And if any American announcer ever referred to what the hockey players wear over their pads as a sweater, and not a jersey, I would turn off the broadcast because, no, it's not a sweater. It was a sweater 80 years ago in Montreal, and it's not a sweater anymore anywhere in the United States. It's a jersey.
That is true.
Look, half walls is pretty stupid sounding.
And I've never heard anybody say that. That's like a made-up phrase.
Everybody says boards. Yeah. We said boards in peewee hockey in northern New Jersey
That's
50 years ago.
here's my issue with this, by the way. There are 31 NHL teams, 7 in Canada, 24 in the U.S. So you know the old saying, if you owe the bank $1 million, they own you? Mm, but if you owe the bank $100 million, you own the bank? Canada, we pretty much own the NHL.
Oh, man, I wish you hadn't said that. The letters, oh, no, the emails, oh, no. Oh, no, hey.
Forward them to Patrick.
Honestly, Canada, love you guys. Appreciate your concern. You're upset about cultural reappropriation. That's what happens when things cross borders. If you don't like it, don't take our money. And maybe see if your politicians are willing to build a half wall. By the way, the best story in hockey this year is a team in Las Vegas.
Las Vegas, yes.
Yeah, yeah. How Canadian is that? I mean, I don't know if this is true, but I'm pretty sure if you score a goal, like nickels start pouring off the scoreboard. So I think Canada does need to find other things to worry about.
My guests for this week's Three Stories You Should Know have been sports writer and editor Patrick Ruby and WBUR Shira Springer, who also writes for the Boston Globe. Thanks to both of you.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Bill.
Don Cherry, perhaps you've heard of him. Since the 80s, he's been one of the stars of the TV show Hockey Night in Canada, where he's famous for his strong opinions.
He's got to suck it up and stop getting stupid penalties.
And also for his loud jackets and pants and ties and occasionally hats.
I was told by a woman named Olga that I looked like a Ukrainian eggplant.
Our next story features a different side of Cherry and a little-known fact about the colorful commentator's coaching career. Here's Only a Game's Martin Kessler.
Jeff Nisely can remember the times he's been in his car listening to sports talk radio when the hosts bring up Don Cherry. They mention that Cherry coached Bobby Orr in the Boston Bruins in the 70s and that he won both NHL and AHL Coach of the Year honors. But then they bring up one of the knocks on Cherry. He never coached a team to a championship. And whenever Jeff Nisely hears that, he has the same reaction.
I would love to call in on some of these radio shows and say, oh, contraire, he does have a championship ring. It should be known that he did coach a championship team.
Jeff Nisely grew up in Pittsford, New York, a suburb of Rochester. Back then, he went by Nyes. He and his friends grew up playing hockey on the Erie Canal and rooting for the Rochester Americans. In the mid-60s, the Americans, or the Amerks to locals, were one of just 9 teams in the American Hockey League, the minor league for the NHL. Here are 2 of Nyes's old friends from Pittsburgh, Al Viverberg and John Hoff.
You could actually bring beer into the games back then. People would bring a six-pack with them.
You could holler through some chicken wire.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Way before glass.
Hockey was rough back then. Players didn't wear helmets. But even in a rock'em sock'em era, there was one Amerks player who seemed to rock and sock harder than everyone else. Veteran defenseman Don Cherry.
He was tough as nails. Really tough guy.
I can remember when we were up in Quebec playing the Quebec Aces.
This is Jay Hill, another Pittsburgh native.
And the lead story in the 11 o'clock news was Don Cherry got in a fight with a guy, and it lasted like 40 minutes. They kept coming out of the penalty box. They couldn't break it up.
But around the time that Jay, Al, John, and Nyes were getting ready to enter Pittsburgh High School, Don Cherry decided that at 35 years old, he'd had enough. Cherry retired from hockey in 1969 and was looking to start a new career in Rochester.
I worked 2 years on construction and I was laid off, and I actually, for about 2 months, I couldn't get a job. I played 16 years pro, and then to not to be able to have a job, it was very humiliating.
It was during that down period in Don Cherry's life when a man connected to Pittsburgh High School approached him.
And he said, "How about, Don, you coaching?" And I said, "Well, I don't know." He said, "Well, you got nothing else to do."
The logic was persuasive. Don Cherry accepted his first coaching job, leading the Pittsburgh High School hockey team. The news made its way to John and Al. What was your reaction that this guy who got into 40-minute fights was now going to be your coach?
Well, Nyes thought he could take him. I think we were all a little intimidated.
I thought it was just so cool.
When winter came, it was time for the boys to meet their new coach.
Our very first practice ever, we were on the ice waiting for Don, and he stepped on the ice with his skate guards on and went down like a ton of bricks. We didn't know if he should laugh, what should we do, but as I recall, we kind of said, well, he's a regular guy.
And from that day on,
we couldn't wait to get to practice.
We used to practice at 5 o'clock in the afternoon. He would get there at 4, and we would battle to get there at 4 so we could sit and put our stuff on and listen to him tell us hockey stories. Loved it.
I think what I did was I got there early to show that I was interested, that I didn't show up just to coach.
The boys knew their coach cared, but he wasn't perfect.
He struggled with names. my name's Jay, but I was always Jack. For 3 years, I was Jack. He couldn't pronounce...
My last name, Viverberg, I was Viberg.
So I don't ever remember him yelling at us. We just wanted to play so hard for him that he never got, you know, coaches get frustrated and all that stuff. We tried our hardest from day one till the end.
In Cherry's second season as coach, Pittsburgh reached the league championship, losing in overtime. Soon, it wasn't just the boys in the Pittsburgh locker room who knew Don Cherry had a knack for coaching. That next year, Cherry returned to the Rochester Americans and was asked to become the team's player coach. But he didn't want to give up his job with Pittsburgh. So for the 1971-72 season, he pulled double duty. He shuttled back and forth from coaching the pros to coaching Pittsburgh. His Amherst team was so-so, but his high school team was stacked. They'd make opponents pay whenever they had a man in the penalty box.
If you asked him today, I'd guarantee he could name our power play from 1972.
On the points, it was Al Viverberg, John Hoff. There were 2 guys that had the screamers from the point. We had a big centerman named Jay Hill. We had a guy named Eddie Scott that used to work in the corners, and Jeff Nisely was the playmaker.
It's Nisely, but close enough. Expectations were high. Cherry occasionally had to miss a game because of the Amherst schedule, but Pittsburgh kept winning. They finished the regular season with an undefeated record and once again reached the championship. But there was a problem. On the day of the big game, Cherry was scheduled to fly out with the Amherst. There was a chance that he'd have to leave before the championship was over. Pittsburgh jumped out to a lead, but the clock wasn't on Cherry's side. In the middle of the third period, he had to leave the Pittsburgh bench.
Kind of inch up the stair. He didn't really want to leave.
I can still see him at the top of the rink. He was holding planes up and everything.
Yeah.
And we scored a goal to cement it.
And I think he was like, okay, it's in hand.
Yeah, I went right to the last minute. I said, Don, if you don't leave now, you're going to miss the plane. So I had to leave them.
Pittsburgh hung on for the championship and an undefeated season. What did it feel like to have to celebrate the championship, though, without him there?
He was with us.
John, Al, Jay, and Nyes all went on to play college hockey. Suiting up for a regular Division I college coach was an adjustment.
Al and I went and stayed together and went to RIT to play hockey, and we had a coach that could barely skate. I mean, talk about a letdown.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Don Cherry's time in Rochester was coming to an end, too. Nyes was helping at one of Cherry's summer camps when he got the news.
He came in one morning and said, "You won't believe it, boys, but I've got the call to go coach the Bruins, and I have to leave in 2 days." And he said something like, "What do I say to Mr. Orr and Mr. Esposito?"
From afar, the boys from Pittsford cheered on their old coach. And when John found himself in Boston, Cherry invited him to a game.
I ended up in the locker room with him, and we split a six-pack of beer, a Bud, in his office off the locker room after that game. I'm just a kid.
Turns out, Cherry really liked reminiscing about his high school team. Here's Al.
I went down to see him at his hockey camp at Lakeshore one time. I walked in the locker room, and Mike Milbury was in there. Three or four other NHL and AHL players. And he goes, "Al Vyverberg, now that was a power play." He starts pointing at all these other guys. "You know, if you guys play power play like my high school team," and they're all looking at him like he's absolutely nuts.
The Pittsford boys always rooted for their former coach to lead Boston to the Stanley Cup. And Cherry's Bruins did reach the finals twice, but they never won. Cherry coached Boston for 5 seasons, then spent a year with Colorado. He's been on Hockey Night in Canada ever since, and his fame in the hockey world has only grown.
All my life, I've enjoyed telling people that I played for Don Cherry.
Same.
Me too.
Years after Cherry's NHL coaching career was over, Nyes went to visit him at one of his restaurants in Toronto.
The bar was full, and he came running out, put his hands up in the air, and he goes, "People, one of my players is here." It's the first time I ever signed autographs. They all thought I played for him in professional hockey, and it was our high school team.
The guys from Pittsford know that, to the average hockey fan, they're not as important as Cherry's former NHL players, even if they were the ones to deliver him his only championship. But hearing all the Pittsford boys' stories left me with one last question for Don Cherry. I wonder if you view them differently from your former NHL players that you coached.
Oh, no, I don't. I think of them very fondly. I think, actually, I'm more closer to them than my pro, because let's face it, they were the guys that made me.
That story was reported and produced by Only a Game's Martin Kessler. Thanks to listener Gary Brandt for tipping us off to this one. If you've got a good idea for Only a Game, send us an email at oag@wbur.org. Writer Elon Fisher enrolled at the New York Military Academy in 1959. He was classmates with a guy named Don.
"From the day we arrived in military school as new guys, we slammed our bodies against the wall whenever an old guy walked past. We were the scum of the earth and announced that to the world 12 times each day."
Just ahead on Only a Game, Elon and Don take to the baseball field. And remember to follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game NPR.
I'm Scott Detrow. There is so much political news to follow these days, but you don't have to keep up with all of it. You just have to keep up with us on the NPR Politics Podcast. You can find us on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Next week on Only a Game, we bring you Hutar of the dreaded Yondu Ravager Clan from Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2. And I'm not kidding. This guy once played college hoops. But right now it's time for my conversation with Charlie Pierce about this week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Yes, he was thrown out of the NCAA because he ate an opponent once on national television.
No, now don't give the story away.
Oh, sorry about that.
The Cleveland Cavaliers struggled at times during the regular season, but against Toronto, they are starting to look like strong contenders for the title once again. What happened? Did bench step up or something?
No, LeBron James became LeBron James all over the Toronto Raptors. Yeah. It's 1 and 1A with Michael Jordan at this point in terms of who's the best player who ever lived.
The NBA had to step in after the rapper Drake, who's also a huge Raptors fan, exchanged, quote, bad language with the Cavs' Kendrick Perkins in Game 1. I thought the league kind of liked to thrive on this sort of publicity.
Well, I think they stepped in also to keep Drake from being killed by Kendrick Perkins.
Yeah, he's a big guy.
Kendrick Perkins, we know in Boston, he's a big, tough guy, and Drake has a big, tough mouth. And, you know, this is the kind of beef, as the kids say, that happens.
The Philadelphia 76ers had a strong season, and they're currently in a second-round battle against the Boston Celtics. Back in December, at least one member of the Sixers did not foresee making the playoffs. So what was Philly guard J.J. Redick planning to do instead?
He was going to be studying for his graduate school exams, the GMAT.
Thought he'd have time.
Yeah, well, you know what? He could have missed a few shots and made his test. That's all I'm saying. That's not point shaving either, by the way.
Washington Capitals forward Tom Wilson was suspended for 3 games after his devastating high hit on Pittsburgh's Zach Aston-Reese in Game 3 of their second-round series. I thought this kind of thuggery generally went away during the NHL postseason.
Oh, no. This is the kind of thing that hockey will never, ever fully lose. There's always going to be some goon out there who spoils the postseason, and this year it happens to be Tom Wilson.
In September, the Boston Bruins are going to play 2 exhibition games against the Calgary Flames in China, which will also be the site of the 2022 Winter Olympics. If the idea is to spread the word about hockey to China, wouldn't it make sense to include the NHL players in those 2022 Olympics?
You would think, but that experiment is gone. And besides, you know, you can sell the game without selling the pros. And the Chinese are apparently going hockey mad at this point. They're building hundreds of rinks all over the country. And within 5 or 10 years, you're going to see Chinese players in the NHL. I would almost guarantee it.
Ichiro Suzuki returned to the Seattle Mariners for the 2018 season. We commented on that when the announcement was made. But he announced this week that he'll be assuming a front office role. I wonder if he can possibly be as successful there as he has been over the past couple of decades on the field.
No, but I'm glad this is happening because he's clearly got nothing left in the tank. I mean, you don't want to see him stumble around as last year. He's a tremendous player. He's been one of the really amazing stories in baseball over the last couple decades. And who knows, maybe he's a good personnel guy.
The April stats are in for Major League Baseball, and perhaps the most striking number is 6,656 strikeouts during the month of April and only 6,360 hits. Strikeouts have never before exceeded the number of hits during a month. Should Major League Baseball be worried?
First of all, unless pitching has just gotten outstanding between seasons, I thought the whole thing with baseball was taking pitches and working the count and so forth. Maybe the pitchers have gone on and said, well, if they're going to work the count, I'm just going to throw strikes.
I'll strike them out while they're working the count. Yeah, maybe that's it. Or maybe the strikeouts are just because all these guys are hitting a lot of home runs.
Well, that's entirely possible, too. People are swinging harder, maybe.
Relievers who don't get guys out are sometimes punished by their managers, of course. They get benched, but they rarely punish themselves the way Astros reliever Ken Giles did the other night. On the way to the dugout, after he had given up a home run in the ninth inning, he punched himself in the face.
I
haven't seen a pitcher do that before.
And then the bench is cleared, which was very strange.
Yeah, then he punched out the dugout.
That's right. Ken Giles could turn out to be Mariano Rivera. But he's always going to be the guy who punched himself in the face.
Man, that's right. And finally, Charlie, rookies are often sent on errands for team veterans, of course. But here's a new twist on that story. The Colorado Rockies made rookie outfielder Noel Cuevas go on a coffee run in full uniform. The guy had to wheel a cart full of coffee around the streets of Chicago dressed in his away togs.
And he looks terrific. He looks like he's having a great time. But doesn't this remind you of the scene in Woody Allen's Bananas where the Revolution sends out for sandwiches?
Oh, the sandwiches, yeah. 4,281 tuna fish sandwiches, yeah.
One without mayo.
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce in Sports Illustrated from time to time. And, of course, he joins me each week on Only a Game as well. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
If there's a clear thread through this week's stories, it's that memory is a funny thing. Some memories fade with time, others remain crisp and clear. This next story is about one of the latter, a powerful memory retained, and it comes to us from writer Elon Fisher, who was known in his younger days as Al.
Don and I went to military school together. We started New York Military Academy on the same day in 1959, as eighth graders and new guy plebes. We lived in Wright Hall, F Company, under the watchful eye of the Mage, Major Theodore DeBias, our officer and our coach. From the day we arrived in military school as new guys, we slammed our bodies against a wall whenever an old guy walked past. We were the scum of the earth and announced that to the world a dozen times each day. Equality between new guys and old guys was only found on the academy sports field, where Don and I played baseball, and there too, Mage was our coach. In 2001, I visited with the Mage. I hadn't seen him for more than 30 years. We talked about Don. "Al," Mage said, "do you remember that day?" "Yes," I said, no further prompting necessary. Mage stands behind me on the pitcher's mound. It's batting practice. I'm 14. Don, the batter, moves to the plate, twists his body, sets his stance, and digs his back foot into the ground. I see it. He's dug in. The relationship between pitcher and batter is a bit like bull and matador. The bull paws the ground and digs in to signal that this arena belongs to him. Al, the Mage cautions, he's dug in. Even though it's only practice, Mage wants me to react. I nod. Now it's my turn to reveal the ground's true owner. Before the academy, there were days when my father came home from work early to drill me in the physics and strategies of pitching baseballs. Leaving work early signaled that pitching was important stuff. In those days, I weighed next to nothing, but I could kick my leg high in the air and concentrate all my next to nothing weight into a baseball, and I knew exactly what to do when a batter clawed his foot into the ground. I wind up, kick my leg, and throw hard for his knuckles. The ball is in the air. In my mind, I smile. What's Don thinking? Is it a curveball? Will I look the fool when I jump back and the ball breaks in for a strike? Then he sees it. Then he knows. Don dives too late. His head finds the ball. There's a hollow plastic whack sound when a baseball and batter's helmet collide. His helmet flies into the air. Don goes down. My heart thuds. I'm not happy. He's Don. He's one of us. Don jumps up, picks up his helmet, brushes himself off. Mage jogs in to talk to him. Is he okay? I wasn't throwing for his head, Mage. He dove into it. In the batter's box, Don flexes and rotates his body. He brushes more dirt from his shirt. He takes a few slow practice swings, looks at me, sets his face, cocks his bat, and then he digs his back foot into the ground. I put my foot on the rubber and take a deep breath. Don's dug in. He's looking for leverage. He's looking for balance. He's looking to take my pitch and send it on a long, long ride. "Al," the Mage barks. I step off the rubber and walk around the mound. "Pitch him," the Mage orders, "and pitch him right." I want to pitch him some easy strikes. Let him make contact. It's batting practice. It doesn't count. I go into my windup. I rock backwards to begin my kick. I still haven't committed to a pitch. Don is dug in and ready. I kick my leg high in the air. I still don't know if I'll pitch him inside or outside. Make him chase. Make him jump. Teach him the folly of digging in on me for two pitches in a row. My leg pulls down. My arm shoots forward. The catapult is in motion. The ball releases. I see the ball fly. I see it. I scream, "Don!" I run for him. I run to beat the ball home, to beat the ball to its destination. It catches him just by the ear, right there, where head, helmet, ear, and cheekbone all meet. His helmet pops and flies. Don goes down. I run, but the Mage beats me to him. He slides into him. Dirt flies everywhere. Mage rolls him from his stomach onto his back. I'm there right behind him. I drop down and touch my teammate's arm. I want to say I'm sorry, but suddenly his body shakes and flails. I'm caught off guard, and I yank back my hand. Then he is still. His face is white, flat, the color of dust, the color of his colorless hair. He is dead, and I killed him. My eyes lock on the dead boy's face. Nothing is clear to me. I'd let go of the ball. The helmet flew. Don was dead, and I killed him. I move to the backstop and grab hold of the fence. My arms shake. I try to hold them still. Don is dead. I saw his face, and I know that I will see his dead face like that every day and forever, forever. There is a sound, movement, from where the team stands around Don and the mage. I push at the backstop and brush away vomit with my hand. I hear applause. All right, Don. Way to go, Trump. Mage sits next to Don Trump on the bench. The team mills around them. No one wants to stare. Mage claps his hands and barks out orders that set the team to running laps around the field. Mage looks at me. You special? Run the field and catch a shower. In those days, from that school, they didn't send kids to the hospital for being knocked out. After all, we were tough kids, military school kids, cadets. And in those days, no one beside us had ever heard of Donald Trump. Mage Trump and I and our teammates, old guys and new guys, saw each other every day after that. We marched, we braced, we ate square meals, and declared ourselves scum. In all that, nobody mentioned that Trump had died, and I never thought about it again. Not until that day when the maid said, "Do you remember?" And I remembered.
That's writer Elon Fisher. We asked Elon to contact his former NYMA teammates to see if they could verify his memory of that day. He talked to a few who remembered playing baseball with the future president, but none of them remembered this particular incident. Major Theodore Tobias died in 2016. Elon sent a copy of his essay to Mr. Trump, addressed to the White House press office, and he sent another copy through a former assistant of Trump's. He received a letter back on White House stationery signed by the president. "Dear Elon, thank you for your thoughtful letter," it begins. "I enjoyed hearing from you and appreciate you taking the time to write to me." Mr. Trump's letter did not acknowledge or refute the events Elon Fisher wrote about in his essay. Only a Game is produced by Martin Kessler and Gary Wallach with help from Alex Schroeder. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. Our intern is Dave Sousa, and our senior producer is Karen Given. I'm Bill Littlefield. We return next week with more sports on Only a Game. Thanks for listening.